Greetings and salutations. Welcome to the second episode of Platters That Matter on PopDose.com. My name is Chris Holmes, and I'm joined once again by D.W. Dunphy. Together, we undertake something that's never been attempted before on the internet, and that is to talk obsessively about music. In this episode, we look at Duke, the 10th studio album by Genesis. It was released on the Charisma label, or Atlantic here in the U.S., in March of 1980, and captures the band at a crucial point in their history, as they were in the process of transforming from one of the most revered progressive rock bands of the 1970s into one of the most successful pop rock bands of the 80s. But before we dive into the songs, D.W., any opening thoughts you want to share on Duke?
Well, a couple of things. The first thing is that when you listen to Duke, you're really hearing a band that is right smack in the middle of transition. A lot of people will say that their album prior to this, which was And Then There Were Three, which alludes to the fact that Steve Hackett was gone from the guitar, and it was just Tony Banks, Phil Collins, and Mike Rutherford now. You know, it had its hit single off of Follow You, Follow Me was on that. But on this album, you hear the points where they are really striving for maximum pop audience, and it works out very well simply because they don't leave that other side, the progressive side, behind, but they manage to integrate it. So most people, you know, I'm of the mind that I enjoy this era of Genesis a lot, but there's a lot of people that consider Abacab to be the big, quote, sellout, unquote. But you can definitely hear this is where they're headed, and it comes through on Duke, and hopefully people will get what I'm saying as we discuss it further tonight.
Yeah, I really enjoy And Then There Were Three. It was one of the first Genesis albums after the Gabriel era that I gravitated to, but it's definitely a transitional album. They had lost Hackett. They had just come off the tour that resulted in the Seconds Out album, fantastic live album, and they had produced two albums after Gabriel, Trick of the Tail and Wind and Wuthering, and I think that they were very clear in their intentions to move away from that thick, gauzy, progressive sound, but they weren't quite ready to abandon it yet. Maybe they didn't feel completely confident in their pop songwriting abilities, whatever the case may be. It's definitely, I guess clunky is the best word I would use to describe And Then There Were Three. There were some moments of real inspiration on there, but there were definitely some really weak songwriting moments. Some of the arrangements were a little limp. Some of that album really dragged, I don't know. I think Duke is probably the last completely cohesive album that Genesis released. Even if you move over to Abacab in 81, some fantastic songs on that album as well, but man, it really plods and kind of runs out of steam at the end, where they just go straight for the commercial side and some really dull arrangements. I think Duke was the perfect marriage of their progressive past and their pop inclinations, and I think it scores maximum impact points, not just on the more progressive slash classical tinged pieces, but on the pop numbers as well, which are all outstanding.
Yeah, and something else which really comes through on this album is that, for lack of a better term, this is really where angry Phil comes to the fore. And what I mean by that is some of the songs that we really associate with Phil Collins' rock side, where he's just got that viciousness in his voice, and that's really what grabs people during this time. Before that, when you're thinking about his singing on Wind and Wuthering and A Trick of the Tail, he's almost hitting a falsetto, which he's sort of abandoning here, and he's just all out. He's letting his inner Otis Redding sort of rip out, and you can hear that. Definitely on Man of Our Times, which, of course, we will get into in a moment. But you can hear that he's just ready to assume that role as I am the front man and he's going to give it all he's got. I think this is the album where it really comes through.
If I had to postulate, I would think of a couple reasons why that would be. One, I think by this point, so we're now talking about this is the fourth album since Peter Gabriel left the band. You had to think that at this point he was getting pretty confident in his role as the front man, which, as any Genesis fan knows, was a role that was thrust upon him out of necessity rather than something that they sought to do. He was kind of their last option after they auditioned a bunch of replacements for Peter Gabriel that said, oh, screw it. We got Phil. We know he's been able to sing in the past. Let's give him the job. And I think the second factor in this is the material. This is the most personal album that Genesis had produced to date, and probably the most personal they would produce again until We Can't Dance. Obviously, a lot of this album's material is informed by Phil's personal life. Even though he didn't write all the songs, he was going through a pretty rough time in his life. His first marriage was in the process of crumbling. He took a little time off from the band in an effort to save that marriage, which ultimately failed. That dissolution of the marriage is documented quite starkly, both on this album and on his first solo album, Face Value, which actually shares one of the songs in common. With the experience of being the lead singer and really the conviction of the material, that gave him the push he needed to just let loose and really give everything he had as a vocalist for the first time, and in my mind, prove himself as a worthy lead singer, which I've always felt he was, but maybe he didn't for a time.
That's true. But I think also for the people that are thinking, okay, now this is just the next phase of the ascent of Phil Collins, the solo artist, that would be a mischaracterization, because as is on a lot of the best Genesis albums, there are a lot of moments where it is really informed by the musicianship. And there's no greater example of that than originally the first four songs on side one, which comprise Behind the Lines, Duchess, Guide Vocal, and Man of Our Times, and the last two on side two, Duke's Travels and Duke's End, originally were written to be sort of a suite that went together, but it was assumed that it was cutting too close to Supper's Ready, and they didn't want to draw that comparison to the Gabriel era too much, and it wound up being broken up, and yet it still worked, because instead of binding five or six tracks together for a side, it somehow binds the entire album together. It gives it that cohesiveness that you were speaking of.
Yeah, I really think that Duke is the last what you can consider a concept album from Genesis, not in the respect that it follows a narrative, but the songs, whether lyrically or just in terms of the mood and the atmosphere that they create, really seem to be of one piece, and it seems like there was a shared mindset amongst the three songwriters, and what they wanted to set out to do. Whereas, as I mentioned before, an album like And Then There Were Three, it seems like there were songs where maybe they wanted to dip their toe back into the progressive world, but they felt this pressure to just write about whatever. And as a result, you get a song like Scenes from a Night's Dream, or I think that's the name of it, the one from Little Nemo, which is just, oh God, it's so terrible lyrically. And here, you wouldn't know that they split up that suite to kind of bookend the album. It really just flows so beautifully and really does an excellent job of creating that mood and that atmosphere of, I don't want to say despair, but breakdown, the ending of relationships, almost a, not quite a depressing mood, but a very dour, downcast mood. It's also interesting to me when I think about some of Genesis' contemporaries at the time, and how as the new decade of the 80s began, they all in their own way started to move away from the material they were doing in the 70s. So two bands that come to mind immediately would be Rush and Yes, a couple other commercially somewhat successful groups who were taking steps away from their more complex past, Rush most drastically on the Permanent Waves album. And some of that album, in fact, was meant to be included on a much more traditional progressive rock album, and almost at the last minute or midstream, they decided, yeah, you know what, we're kind of done with this stuff. Let's try to explore shorter song structures. You know, let's try to make a more streamlined album. And Yes, although they released Drama this year, 1980, that was their last great progressive stand, if you will, until they started to tread old ground back in the 90s. But then the next album after this, of course, was 90125. So I don't know, it was almost like there was something in the air amongst all these groups that we need to try something new, we need to try something fresh. And I'm not sure what that was. Maybe it was, you know, a reaction to punk. I know that's thrown out a lot, but I'm not so certain how true that is. But
it could be a reaction to punk. It could also be a reaction to MTV. You're not going to get your video played if your song is about 8 minutes long. It's just not going to happen. I would add to the groups that you were talking about, even though the album Discipline is pretty thick as far as things go with King Crimson, but I would say after that you had Beat and Three of a Perfect Pair, and each one of those two albums has a song that could rightly be considered a single. I'm thinking mostly of Beat because that had Heartbeat on it, which Adrian Belew would then take and record on one of his later solo albums. And you wouldn't really have a problem with that being released as a single. So there were a lot of bands from the progressive era, from that really old guard progressive era, who were saying, you know, there's really nothing wrong with pop structure. We can still do it our way, but we do not have to have full album sides to prove anything at this point. And a lot of them really produced some of their most memorable material, although I take a lot of flack from people in terms of Genesis, because I always say that I like Phil Collins era stuff just a little bit more than Peter Gabriel stuff, and I don't, you know, even though I like it, The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, it's not an album I go back to all the time, and I'm looked at like I'm the Antichrist when I mention this to people.
I was actually thinking about this on the way home today, that exact comparison between Duke and Lamb, and I have to say, I'm probably joining you in sacrilege by saying that I'm not going to say Duke is a better album, because of course that's impossible to quantify. I most definitely prefer it, and I listen to it a lot more. The Lamb, as much of a creative achievement as it was, is sort of this monolith that you really just have to be in a certain mindset for, and I'm not even talking mood-altering substances. It's definitely not nearly as approachable as Duke. I feel like some of the impact, the emotional impact that Duke has, The Lamb does not have, mostly because it's fictional. And really, who among us that's, you know, in our 30s, 40s, whatever, and older, has the time or the inclination to sit down on a regular basis and listen to a double album of progressive rock all that often?
Right. It can be sort of taxing. If you are in the space and time where you can do that, it is a rewarding album. I don't want to sound like I'm denigrating it, but as an album that works as a whole and in its constituent parts, Duke really does stand above that. As a matter of fact, I would say if you are thinking, unless you are a real serious prog fan, you may know one song from The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, and that is the title, and that is because it worked its way into a lot of the latter Genesis tours. And that's about it. A lot of that material has not been played out. People don't know it. And yet, on Duke alone, there's going to be at least two songs that you know because you heard it on the radio. So,
yeah, well, I think it's high time we got into some of those songs. So you mentioned the suite that got split into pieces. So let's tackle the first part of the first side. But we have Behind the Lines starting off the album.
We'll be right back.
really feel that this is the song that they intended Down and Out to be, to lead off And Then There Were Three, not in terms of subject matter, but they clearly wanted to, with Down and Out, create a really powerful, propulsive statement to open an album. And as excellent as Down and Out is, and it is probably one of the three best songs off of that record, Behind the Lines at least matches it and probably betters it in most respects. It's such a powerful statement to open this album, and they apparently agreed because they revisited the theme later in the album at the end of the second side, but you know, we'll get into that. The curious thing to me in looking at Behind the Lines is how differently it was interpreted by Phil Collins, both at the beginning of Duke and as redone on his Face Value album. The same lyrics, the same song, but just two completely different moods, two completely different types of musical statements, and I'd be lying if I said that the one on Face Value was even a distant second.
Yeah, I need to make something clear before we go on. I actually made a mistake before. Man of Our Times was not a part of the suite, but Turn It On Again is. So I before we moved any farther, I just wanted to clarify that because my brain is not working tonight. Behind the Lines, I think that what it does very well is that it is actually one of the poppier songs on this album. And so I think when people put this on and they hear it, they're already getting in their mind, this is a different sort of Genesis than what you got when you opened up Wind and Wuthering and you got 11th Earl of Mar. You are being invited into this story, as it were. And I like it because you know that it is a part of a whole, as we're going to go into. But it works on its own. And that's always, for me, that is the mark of when you are really considerate about how you're writing the music. If you are a prog rock sort of writer, you have the idea of the bits and the pieces and how they stand alone like chapters, and then you have the whole, and if you break it up, it works. If you listen to it all the way, it works as well. And Behind the Lines, as an introduction to the album, I think they probably couldn't have done any better with any of the other tracks on this album. Nothing else quite works as the opening for this album.
Yeah, it really jumps right out and grabs you. One of the things I have to confess here is an entry in the log of misheard song lyrics. My first copy of Duke was one of the CD copies they came out with in America in probably late 80s, early 90s, whenever those original issues were. This was prior to the remaster campaign they did in the mid to late 90s. And so I had a completely different impression of this song. I obviously picked up most of the lyrics, but there's a refrain that's uttered two or three times in the album or in the song, and it says, "It is written in the book." And I heard those words for many, many years, up until very recently, as just returning my book. I thought that this was some kind of ode to a librarian, either as an object of desire or just, you know, an actual librarian that maybe Mike Rutherford had a crush on. I don't know what the hell I was thinking, but to this day, even though I know what the actual lyric is and, you know, it does make sense, I still have a hard time not singing, you know, just returning my book. So I'm just going to go on the record with that shameful admission. We have, you know, there's at least another dozen songs where I have ridiculous interpretations, but that's what comes with buying a cheap CD issue with no lyric sheet. So thanks a lot, Atlantic Records, for making me look like a jackass.
That was the glory days of the first CD releases, where you were lucky if you got anything other than the CD and the album cover art.
Yeah.
So,
but getting into the lyrical theme of this, you wouldn't know that this was an actual Mike Rutherford tune, because knowing what Phil Collins was going through in his personal life, you would guess that he wrote the words to this album. And unless every source that I've consulted is wrong, it is in fact Mike Rutherford, who, as far as I know, still is married to the same woman he was several decades ago. But yet this perfectly encapsulates, or I would imagine, perfectly encapsulates the feelings of somebody watching their relationship with their loved one crumble and being fairly powerless to do anything about it. And it's powerful. It's a very powerful lyrical song, and it only gets better from there. The end of this song segues perfectly, and you probably have to at least partially credit David Henschel, who had now had several albums under his belt producing with Genesis. This segues very effectively into Duchess with that sort of interesting electronic percussion sound effect, that almost droning electronic drum effect leading into Duchess.
Duchess, I think, is one of the songs that really jumps out as far as I'm assuming that Phil Collins had sort of the weight of the lyrics on this one. I could be wrong. I don't really know. But this is definitely the song where I don't want to say venom, but there's definitely a feeling that someone is being called out for not being a full person in the other person's eyes. Let's put it this way. The lyric goes, "And she dreamed that every time that she performed, everyone would cry for more, that all she had to do was step into the light and everyone would start to roar." And it's just sort of an idea of an inauthenticity. And maybe I'm reading that completely wrong, but it's like somebody who has a vision of what they believe they are, and yet they're nothing like that. And therefore, if you're feeding this into the narrative of Phil Collins and his wife, it's sort of him saying, you know, you believe you are this, but this is what you're projecting. That's not an easy thing to write in a song with a certain amount of maturity. Most pop music, rock music, it is, "You're a lion, stinking, blankety-blank, I hate you, go to hell."
Yeah.
So trying to deliver this in some way that makes you want to dig into what they're actually talking about, it showed a great level of maturity when it could have been much more bitter. And in fact, Collins, in other work later down the line, actually, He lost control of that bitterness. Some of that really comes through in some of his later relationships that also fell apart. So,
yeah, I think even of this same era, look at In the Air Tonight. Very little attempt, I don't care what he says in subsequent interviews, very little attempt to hide anger in that song. Or if you want to look at something from another English songwriter that popped into my head as you were describing this, is our old buddy Andy Partridge, doing Your Dictionary off one of the last XTC albums, which may just about be one of the most angry "I hate you, bitch" songs I think I've ever heard in my life. That's of the pop rock genre.
Done in a perfect sing-song style where you don't expect to hear what you're hearing, you know. But we'll leave XTC for another day, because yeah, we could talk for hours about the Freudian slips, or maybe non-slips, coming from Andy Partridge. But
one of the great things I think about Duchess, and this is an example of how art, I think, is treated depending on where you are at your station in life. I probably could have led off this episode with this, but this album came to me at a point in my life where I'm now a freshman in college. And without divulging too many details, let's just say that I pined for somebody who I went to school with pretty hard, like fell for her super hard. And this was one of the albums that just, you know, those albums that come into your life at just the right time, they speak to you on a gut level that you don't even really understand at that time. This was one of those albums. And so a song like Duchess, where the lyrics are obtuse enough that you can really appropriate them for yourself if you want to. That's exactly what I did in projecting this other person who I have these feelings for that to this day, I don't know if she really knew at the time. But, you know, I almost took the Phil Collins role, but instead of taking the place of somebody who is watching a relationship dissolve, it was mourning a relationship that never was and never would be. And I think that that's, you know, the flexibility in those lyrics, and but yet the emotional potency in those lyrics just, you know, hit me like a gut punch.
Yeah, I think that really leads to the next track, which is one of the shortest on the album by, you know, only a minute and a half. But God, if you're talking about a punch, there's no song that ends on this album quite as hard as this is, and that's Guide Vocal. Now, for anyone who doesn't really understand what a guide vocal is, when you are writing, if you're a musician and you're writing, sometimes it's helpful to just mutter some words as you're writing the music so you know where to place instrumentation, things like that. That's a guide vocal. The vocalist will just, you know, just blurt things. It's kind of the musical version of automatic writing. And if that is the case, then you listen to the lyrics that are on here. And it's, I was the one who guided you this far. All you know and all you hear. And it goes on, I'm the one who brought you to this place. And the last line of the song is, take what's yours and be damned. In essence, just get out. Just leave me alone. And it is done to a plaintive piano, which really points to Phil Collins' later career as the adult contemporary piano-backed musician that we sort of associate most with him now. But his ballads, for lack of a better term, I guess you could call this a ballad in some way, have never packed this kind of punch. Not even, what is the song from the movie? Take a Look at Me Now. What?
Oh, Against All Odds?
Against All Odds.
Yeah.
Which everybody says is his big, you know, gut-wrenching ballad. This kills it. This beats it all up. And it's just because you do not expect that last line to click it like that. And it does.
And the curious thing to me about this is, again, this is a perfect example of a band totally in sync. It's actually a Tony Banks song.
Yep.
So you have to wonder, there's not as much known about Tony's personal life as there is Phil, mostly because he just doesn't put himself out there. And again, like Mike Rutherford, I'm pretty certain that Tony is still married to the same person he was well before this album was recorded. So I'm left to wonder, is this something that he was going through at this time in his life as well? Or, knowing what Phil was going through, did he have that sort of empathetic streak in him to write that for Phil's voice?
It's a really good question. I happen to feel, I mean, later on, there's this feeling that Phil Collins sort of became the ego of the band, and the rest of the band was sort of trying to keep it together. I have nothing to base that on, except that you see just their personalities sort of diverging. I would imagine, though, at this point, they were probably pretty friendly. After all, they were in a band of five people, now down right to three, and they were willing to stick it out. So there had to be some kind of friendship there. So I would definitely say that there was that empathetic feeling that Mike Rutherford and Tony Banks was having. And at the same time, if Phil Collins is writing songs like this, how awkward would it be if they brought like this big, shiny, sunny pop tune to the table where he's just bringing this, you know, my life is coming down the crap here. So on one level, mere survival as songwriters, maybe. On the other level, it may be that highly sympathetic writing on their part.
And so that brings us to the fourth track of Side A. The first Mike Rutherford tune to make an appearance, and one of only two where he gets soul credit, and that's Man of Our Times. If I had to pick, if we're being honest, my least favorite song from Duke, this would probably be it, although it certainly is no throwaway by any means. It's just that depending on the mood I'm in, I find it a little too droning, dire, I guess is the best word I can think of. And I think this is one instance where the production on the album, which can at times come off as a little brittle, probably does not do the song any favors, and perhaps with a warmer sound it might please my ears a little more than it does, although I'm sure you would probably find 1,000 Genesis fans at any one moment who would strongly disagree with me. But to me, this is the one semi-weak link on an otherwise perfect album.
I think what hits me most about this song is that it for some reason, it really sounds like they're trying to mimic Peter Gabriel, especially in the verse parts that Phil is singing. It sounds like his voice has been recorded at a lower pitch. You know, I don't know whether that was tape effects or whether he was really bringing it down low, but it sounded like he was trying to hit that register that Peter Gabriel was hitting. And it does seem like a bit of a misstep, because in this point where they're really trying to expand into their own thing, it felt like they were trying to reach back, and it doesn't quite work. But on the other hand, like you said before, it's not a throwaway. I never skip over it when it comes up on the CD, but it does not quite fit into the whole as well as the other songs. Now, we're going to be getting into a song in a few minutes that I think that another song would have fit into this space better. We'll get to that in a moment because it involves the next song on our list. But I think that if this song had been swapped out for the song that I'm going to bring up, maybe the album would have been a little more tighter, in my opinion. And we'll move on to that when it comes around.
Okay. Number 5 on the first side is what I would have to classify as perhaps one of the 10 most upbeat songs ever written about somebody being cheated on by a significant other. None of the other titles come to mind at the moment, but I'm sure that there are numerous ones out there. Misunderstanding, which was one of the pop songs that I'm pretty certain you were referring to as one that even casual Genesis fans would be intimately familiar with. Dream has feeling. top 20 song in America. It only made it to number 42 in the UK. I don't understand the Brits sometimes, so we'll just leave that one alone. A very upbeat, even though it's more of a mid-tempo number, I guess cheerful sounding, but it's one of those ones where once you dig just a little bit and look at the lyrics, I mean, he's being very polite. Oh, you know, I see you screwing another man. Oh, there must be a misunderstanding. You know, you didn't show up to our date. So I drove to your house and I saw somebody leaving through the back door. Oh, you know, it must be a mix-up. Must be the milkman. Cheerio.
Yeah.
You know, putting a very brave face on a very sad situation.
Yeah. There's sort of this almost a Motown feeling to it, which I guess plays into Phil Collins' last album was a album of Motown covers. But if you listen to it, it does almost have a slight Motown feeling to it for me. And I think that's what people take away from it. They're not really hearing or reading the lyrics. And if you're just hearing it on the surface, it is. It's probably one of Genesis's, I guess.
Yeah.
Happier sounding songs. And, you know, it's only when you start reading the lyrics and you're singing along, you go, oh, wait a minute. Oh, this isn't a good thing. Yeah. It does sort of sneak up on you. Now, what I was bringing up before is that when this was released as a single, the B-side was Evidence of Autumn, which for me is one of my favorite Genesis songs, full stop.
I'm right there with you, my friend.
And I think the reason why it did not make the album is that it feels too close to Heat Haze, which comes at number six on this side. And so having two songs that felt so close together tonally on the same side may have been a problem. But I think if that was on there instead of Man of Our Times, which seems so strident, in my mind, it might have been a stronger album. Which is saying a lot because it's already a strong album. It's hard to say, but every time I hear Evidence of Autumn, I just crack up because it's gorgeous and it's sad and it's amazing that it was a B-side in my mind.
I think if there's an argument to be made for a song substitution, I would have substituted Evidence of Autumn for Heath Hays instead of Misunderstanding for the exact reason that you state, that the two songs were, I would wager, written in the same session by Tony Banks. I actually think Evidence of Autumn is the superior song of the two, but I think that Heath Hays probably fits the album a little better. And for reasons that I can't quite quantify, although I'll probably chalk part of that up to just that's how I heard the album for so long. I can't imagine any other way. But yeah, any mention of the material produced during the Duke sessions has to include Evidence of Autumn. I dedicated an entire post to it a couple years ago on my own site. It is hands down for me a top 10 Genesis song. It is ridiculous just how a song like this doesn't make the cut on any Genesis album, but, you know, I'll trust the boys on this one. But yeah, I'm glad you brought it up because I absolutely was going to if you didn't.
And it wound up on Three Sides Live, but it's essentially just filling up a side. The single that came off of that one obviously was Paper Late, which fits into the whole No Reply at All big horn section sound that they were going for at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it always bothered me because I think it's number four on that side, five songs. And it's like, how could you bury this song? My God.
Yeah.
But having said that, let's go to you said Heath Hayes. I thought it was Heat Hayes. I'm going to go with yours and say Heath Hayes as well.
Well, I got Simsek right on the last one, so.
So I defer to you. You're obviously better at this than I am.
Sure.
But. Great line in it, which is, "Beware the fisherman who's casting out his line into a dried up riverbed, but don't try to tell him because he won't believe you." In other words, don't bother trying to tell someone they're making a mistake because they are so wrapped up into their dreams and their ideal of what it's going to be, you're not going to be able to get through to them, which is an amazing sentiment wrapped up in just a line that if you're not looking at it, it goes right by. It's just a strange fisherman, you know, who's doing something stupid.
Yeah.
It's not about that. It is about self-deception.
You know, as I ponder this in real time a little more, I think if I had to guess as to why Heath Hayes made the album and Evidence of Autumn did not, the lyrics are somewhat similar in theme on both. They both have to do with longing and loss. I think Heath Hayes is a little more concrete, and I think that fits the tone of this album a little better. Evidence of Autumn is a little more wistful, a little more fantastical, if you will, and I think it probably would have just seemed a little too abstract for this. And this one, even though it's very evocative and very poetic, it probably is a little more direct, and that's what they were going for in this album. The line that I gravitate towards the most is, "The trees and I are shaken by the same wind, but whereas the trees will lose their withered leaves, I just can't seem to let them loose." Who among us has not been in a situation, either a relationship or just anything, where you have this thing that you, this memory, this feeling that you loved so much at some point, and you just refuse to move on, or you can't move on emotionally. It's, you know, who among us can just put it in such a beautiful way, like Tony was able to do on this song.
Right. And as you said, it's done in a beautiful way, where what you're talking about is obsessing about probably a dead relationship. A dead something or other. You are obsessing it. It consumes you in some way. So when you're saying, you know, "The trees and I are shaken by the same wind, but whereas the trees lose the withered leaves," the trees are able to cut away from that which isn't life anymore, which doesn't bring fulfillment. Me, I have to cling to it because I don't know what the hell else I'm going to do. I'm consumed by it. Now, other writers are able to just blurt that out, and it works. But the poetic nature of these lyrics, all throughout the album, these are not easy lyrics, except maybe for the kickoff song on side two, which we're going into.
Yes, yeah, so we get to side two, and we get the big song, the big pop hit, and I would say one of the great pop songs of the early part of the 80s, and that is Turn It On Again. This song reached number 8 in the UK. I don't know what the chart position was in the US. Perhaps you have that handy. Yes, I'm consulting Wikipedia. I'm cheating, folks. Number 58. 58. I don't know. I'm insulted now. You know, Genesis, on behalf of America, I'm sorry. 58 is just inexcusable for this song. You know, as much as I know that they probably weren't obsessed with chart positions, it really is a masterclass in pop songwriting.
And I would agree with that. I would also say it is the least lyrically complex, which I guess really makes it's a standout, and it grabs at you because it's kind of Phil at his most neurotic. I would put it that way. It's just that sort of I'm enclosed, you know. I can show you some of the people in my life, you know. There's a neurosis going on there that is so easy to sing along with. And again, it's angry Phil coming through.
Yeah.
I can't stress enough that when he's got that bite in his voice, you want to sing along with him even though it hurts.
Although, to be fair, it can be taken too far. I, of course, am referencing the live version of this song, which appeared on the Three Sides Live album, featuring the Phil Collins Freak Out interlude. and you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Oh, yes. Yes, I do.
Where he gets to the end and just, I don't know, musical Tourette's. I'm not sure what happened, but sort of a mini spaz attack on stage.
Call that being possessed by the spirit. Yeah. And we'll leave it at that. Yeah.
Lord be praised. This is another instance where I took what were actually fairly direct lyrics. You know, ostensibly this song is about somebody obsessed with television, and it's infiltrated their life to a point where it's all they can think about. You could probably just update these lyrics ever so slightly now to substitute Facebook, Twitter, what have you. But there's a line in there, I get so lonely when she's not there. I talked before about how this was one of my personal, this was part of the soundtrack of my life back in freshman year in college. And I substituted this woman that I referred to for the she's not there. So I just ignored the part about the TV. And I can clearly picture many years later just lying on the bed in my dorm room, singing this out at the top of my lungs, which I'm sure thrilled my sweet mates to no end. You know, having this person's picture, face pictured in my mind, belting out these lyrics. But, you know, riding the crest of emotion in Phil's voice and just kind of tagging along. But that really speaks to the emotional power of the song and of the lyrics that I was able to do that, I think. So we move on to the second track from the second side, and this is our second entry from Mike Rutherford, Alone Tonight. I gone from this really poppy, upbeat number and really moved to a very slow, almost languid sort of number. Maybe I'm just not feeling it with the Mike Rutherford solo stuff. Maybe he's starting to flex his songwriting muscles in the build-up to Mike and the Mechanics. You know, I don't know. I'm not a huge fan of Alone Tonight. It's just a little redundant, but you know, maybe you feel differently.
I enjoy it a lot more than I believe you do.
Okay.
I think that it's plain speak. As far as the lyrics goes, it's pretty on the money. But for myself, in previous relationships I've had where you are kind of, as you were saying, you know, the woman that you want to be with, you sort of realize, yeah, this isn't going to happen. It's just not going to happen. And, you know, you can sort of work your way around how it makes sense, how this is the way it's supposed to be, and you can eulogize it any way you want. And at the end of that road, it's just like, it's just me. I'm just alone again. She's doing whatever she's going to do, and there's nothing you can do about it. And it's that resignation that I think comes through on that song. So of the two Rutherford songs, I gravitate to this one more than Man of Our Times. It's one that sort of strikes at me personally more than other songs on the album do. So,
and I'll leave it at that.
Well, alrighty then.
Funny voice.
Well, see, yes. that's why we have two people doing this, so it's not just one of us blurting out our opinions.
Yeah. Before we move on, though, I want to point out something. Overall, for the album, people may not recognize the name David Henschel. A lot of people are going to think Genesis Hugh Padgham, who was there for arguably their most successful run. But David Henschel, no slouch. He was the engineer for Gus Dudgeon, specifically on Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. The guy knows how to produce an album. Okay, there are a couple points on this album. As you said, it's sort of a brittleness, a coldness to it. But when he warms it up, he really was a good producer for Genesis at this time. So...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I certainly don't mean to... I hope I haven't come across as impugning his work. I think that, if anything, it was And Then There Were Three, where they came up a little bit short in what they were trying to get across. But, one of the things I hate about Spotify, even though I use it all the time, is when you're streaming songs, if an album has been remastered in the interim, it will just play the remastered version automatically if it's coming up on a mix. And so Genesis released a bunch of remasters or remixes or whatever the hell you want to call it about 5 years ago. And Duke was one of the albums that got that treatment, given a much beefier sound, a little more of the low end, a little more filled out. And I hate it. I absolutely hate it. I can only listen to this album in its original incarnation, whether that be on the first CD, whether that be on the vinyl, which I also have. I think that crispness, that harshness or brittleness, whatever term you want to use, is an essential part to me of what makes this album so excellent. You know, had they decided to go back to earlier albums, get the warmer sound, break out the Mellotron, it just would have sounded cheesy and it would have made it sound incredibly dated.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, it's just because that's how I move, I guess. I really enjoy it mostly on vinyl. Because again, with my thing is that you will enjoy these songs separated, as I do when I'm driving in my car and I hear them. But to really get the full thing, I like putting on side one. Listen to side one straight through. Flip it over. Listen to side two straight through. This is one of those albums that works both ways, which is really nice. And I would suggest to everybody, they're going to be re-releasing the albums on vinyl again. I'm sure it will happen soon. Buy it on good, solid heavyweight. If you can, make sure that it is not the newest remaster. You might not be able to do it. If not, go buy one of the original versions of it, because in 1980 they were still making albums pretty good. You know, it was pretty good quality back then. Just get it for $2.
Yeah, this is an album, and I thank you for reminding me of this, because I was going to bring it up before. This is an album that clearly is of the vinyl age, in that side one ends with Heath A's, and sort of that slow fade out gives you that time to pick up that needle, turn it over, and then boom, you have that pop of Turn It On Again and Phil counting off with a cymbal, and you know, Mike coming in with a guitar part. You know, if ever there were an album that was perfectly suited to that sort of separation of time between when you could start the two sides, this is it. It just as enjoyable in that CD straight through format, but a fantastic use of, you know, the medium of the time. So we move on after Mike Rutherford's last entry to another Tony Banks song, and probably one of my favorites from the album. No, I will say one of my favorites from the album, Cul-de-Sac. This is a song musically that I think bears direct lineage from a song like Firth of Fifth. It has a lot of those piano flourishes, those sort of classical music influences, but clearly has a more streamlined pop sensibility. That being said, if you can make heads or tails of what he's referring to in this lyrics other than dinosaurs, or, you know, literally or figuratively, I can't think of it, because even if you want to stretch these lyrics about things going extinct and being, you know, lost to time, if you want to stretch that out and make it about a relationship, I guess you can try to, but man, that would be a reach as far as I'm concerned.
A reach, and, you know, a cul-de-sac, as you know and I know, I guess everybody else knows, it's a road that leads nowhere into just sort of a circle. It sort of continues upon itself into a dead end. So, I mean, you could stretch that out as saying relationships like dead ends, but you're absolutely right. As far as opacity in lyrics, this is probably as opaque as the album gets. This is the extreme, but it's a very good song. It's not one that a lot of what people, the hardcore Genesis fans, as some will call themselves, automatically bring up. It's a very strong song. It definitely is, and it's unmistakably Tony Banks's song.
Yeah, the chord progressions, particularly at the very end of the song, you know, this almost has a cinematic quality about it. It's just a fantastic use of dynamics. You know, it has those forceful, almost aggressive parts. It's got the really sweet kind of bridge section. And then at the very end, it's just got that, I don't know how to put it, but I guess we'll have to play it for people to understand what I'm talking about. But it's probably, outside of the beginning of the album and the end of the album, the most powerful, pure musical statement.
We'll be right back.
So we move from the drama and grandeur of Cul-de-Sac back to a Phil Collins confessional, Please Don't Ask. This is one of the more direct, starkly emotional songs on the album, and one clearly written about and for his wife, or about his relationship. He's mourning the loss of his relationship. He's talking about crying at night, but he's doing pretty good. He misses his son. This is a gut punch. This is really, really strong stuff, and just a really fantastic song.
I think if we're going into key lyrics, what sort of jumps out at me, and I can only half guess why, is when he keeps saying, "You look good." You know, it could be read two ways. He could be sort of being magnanimous, going, "Hey, you know what? You're looking all right. You are one fine looking woman." At the same time, he could be saying, "How is it you look so good through all this and I feel like such a wreck? How is it that you are surviving so well in this and I'm not?" So it could be read one of two ways, but whenever I'm hearing this song, that jumps out, that line.
"I can remember when it was easy to say I love you, but things have changed since then. Now I really can't say if I still do." That's the lyrics. That's not me talking to you, but you are a swell guy.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. It means a lot.
Yeah. As somebody who has had relationships fall apart, not marriages, thankfully, as somebody who is a child of divorce, this song has particular meaning for me. This song resonates very strongly with me. And you know, this is the kind of music that I just don't think would have been possible if Peter Gabriel and Steve Hackett were still in the band. I just don't know if they would have been up for, you know, this kind of confessional song, if you will.
I don't think, maybe Steve Hackett would be up for it now, because apparently he's just going through a divorce of his own now.
Yeah.
But Peter Gabriel, I don't know. I think it's too on the money. I think this is just, it's too close to the bone. Later on in his career, I think that he would have appreciated it, but during his time in Genesis, I don't think it reached far enough.
No, I think at this point, they were, both Peter and Steve, were busy being British and eccentric, and I just don't, it's the best way I can put it, and I just don't know if, as much as I love the old stuff, if you will, you know, this is the kind of song that just has a lot more emotional power and kind of lingers a lot more than, say, Return of the Giant Hogweed.
Right.
You know,
right.
As fun as that stuff is.
And like I was saying before, I think that this is a song that Peter Gabriel would appreciate shortly after he recorded, say, Don't Give Up off of So. I think he would have at that point said, "I can relate to that," but absolutely not during Lamb Lies Down on Broadway would you have been able to fit something this emotionally stark into an album, or even a mindset like that. It wasn't going to happen. So for those people who say that, "Oh, well, he should have stayed with Genesis would have been a lot better," it would have been a lot different, but I think in some ways, things worked out exactly the way they were meant to work out, especially. And that's one of the songs that really brings it there.
If I had one quibble, and I'd like to get your input on this, what do you think of reversing Cul-de-Sac and Please Don't Ask in the running order? The reason I bring that up is because I feel like going from Cul-de-Sac, which again harkens back to the more progressive roots of the band, this very dramatic, cinematic song, Then you move down to Please Don't Ask, and then you move on to the last two songs, which we'll get to in a second. It's a little kind of, you know, kind of a musical whiplash effect, if you will. And I wonder if the flow wouldn't have been just a little better going from Alone Tonight into Please Don't Ask.
It might be, but Please Don't Ask and Alone Tonight sort of have that, not necessarily a tempo similarity, but maybe an emotional similarity in some ways. But I get your point. I think that it is jarring to go from Please Don't Ask to the last two tracks of this album, especially when the last two tracks are resolving the totality of the album. I'm going to have to do an experiment with that. I'll have to make myself a mix and see how that sounds. I'll have to get back to you on that one.
So, speaking of fantastic segues, we're going to move on to the dramatic conclusion of Duke. It's two songs, the original end to the suite that DW mentioned before, Duke's Travels and Duke's End.
Instrumental prowess of the band comes back for everyone who says, "Oh, they're pop stars now." This is the thing that silences that.
This is really, I think, the last great stab at traditional progressive rock that Genesis undertook. They definitely had some weird stuff on the next couple albums, so say Mama, for instance, but not, that was more arty than it was what we know as traditionally progressive anymore. And it's a clear callback to stuff that they had done on previous albums like Trick of the Tail, where you have that instrumental ending of the song that revisits some of the themes from earlier in the album. Los Endos, I'm thinking of in particular. But whereas, in my mind, that was not a throwaway, but it was just more of a, let's see if we can do this exercise. There seemed to be a lot greater sense of purpose to putting Duke's Travels and Duke's End at the conclusion of Duke, and I think it ends the album on such a powerful note. It just is a fantastic bookend to Behind the Lines.
Yeah, and it is a medley. It's a medley of the different songs that came throughout the entire album, essentially, and Guide Vocal gets the nod once again. It is the only lyric in this part. You know, I was the one that guided you this far, all you know and all you hear, etc., etc. It's really telling because it is nearly a 10-minute instrumental.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, you know, in agreement with you when you said that this was really one of their last stabs, but I will commit yet another act of heresy and say that they really tried on We Can't Dance. Fading Lights has an incredible instrumental section toward that end of that. It starts out, that song at least, it starts out with sort of that sad pop stuff that they were doing, and then it kicks into a pretty solid instrumental part. But having said that, you don't feel like they've charged full force into it, whereas on this one they're revisiting the songs, they're going, some of them are a little faster, there's amazing energy among the band. And let's not kid ourselves, Phil Collins was, I guess you can say is, even though he can't do it anymore, one of rock's great drummers. I would not put him up against Neil Peart, who is sort of like, you know, semi-god on the drums, as people will believe. But Phil Collins is an accomplished drummer. Most of the time that he was in Genesis, he was also in sort of the prog jazz band Brand X.
Right.
So he's got chops. All three of them, and Mike Rutherford has been on record as saying he considers himself a very lazy guitarist. But all three of them gel so well on these two bits. And we keep saying two bits. It's really one. Duke's Travels goes right into Duke's End. It's one composition there. It clearly was the right decision to make this the end of the album, as opposed to the end of the side that they were originally considering. It is probably the best way that they could have closed out this album. So,
I think that doing it any other way would have made the rest of the song seem like a letdown. The only way they could have gotten away with that would be to put it on the second side, and then you would have had an extremely backloaded album. But to put it on the first side, I mean, you listen to Duke's End, you're drained. It's definitely, let me amend my statement from earlier. I acknowledge your point about Fading Lights. I had forgotten about it, as much as I enjoy the song and a lot of that album, but again, that's yet another topic for another time. It's probably the most muscular and forceful that Genesis got ever again on a record. Now, what do you think of that?
I think they're stronger here than they were on that. There are points on that one that, you know, having just defended Fading Lights, I'm now sort of backtracking, saying that I think that they've got more meat this time around. But I will say, and I've said many times, I did the 50 Prog 50 for Popdos, and I defended not just that, but the entirety of We Can't Dance, because I think that there are a lot of things like Driving the Last Spike. Mm-hmm. I think that No Son of Mine is a great rock song.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus, He Knows Me is, even though it sounds like latter Genesis, it's got a concept behind it that I don't think any other band would have gotten away with, but since they got away with so much, they were able to do that, which was televangelism without sounding too horrible about it. I think everybody who's listening to this has heard a song or two or 20 where people have gone against televangelists. So I'm a big supporter of that album. But then again, I'm also a big supporter of side one of Abacab. So I guess I'm biased.
Oh, well, listen, side one of Abacab is unimpeachable in my mind. It's really only on the second side where that falls apart. I will also defend We Can't Dance to a point. I think that could have been trimmed down to maybe a 7 or 8 song album and been a fantastic way to end the recording career of that trio.
Yeah.
But as it is, just too much dead weight for me to fully get behind.
It's too much. That was the curse of the early 90s, late 80s with CDs. It was like, oh, wow, we can put 75 minutes of songs. Okay, forget about B-sides. We're just jamming it all in there. And so you have songs on there that do not work in the whole. And there are some songs on there that I actually like a lot, but do not feel like Genesis. Since I Lost You, I think it's Since I Lost You.
Yeah.
It doesn't fit on that album.
It's Dreck. I'm sorry, man. That's Dreck. Tell Me Why. Hold On My Heart. Ugh.
Hold On My Heart is a pretty rough one for me. It's like, you guys are really trying to grab back some of your glory, and I'm hearing it in some of these songs, and then you're giving me Phil Collins solo warmed up.
It was just, that was musical pablum right there. And the reason why I probably put off embracing that album for as long as I did, but look, we can start a new podcast series on, you know, defending maligned albums, and that can be case study number one. However, we are in fact talking about an album that is fairly praised. Now, one of the things I was thinking about, and my memory might be failing me here, as I'm not yet 40, I seem to recall reading a long time ago that Genesis received a pretty negative reaction to some of the material on this album when they took it out on tour, especially from European audiences. Now, I could be completely making that up. There's a photo floating around, and it's actually been used on a number of Genesis bootlegs of Phil Collins giving the finger to the audience. And the story as I read it, and I'm sure a super fan that's listening to this can correct me, and we know our listeners are never shy about sharing corrections with us.
Oh, yes.
That
indeed.
At some concert or a series of concerts, they got a really hostile reception to some of the newer material, and Phil basically was like, fuck you. You're going to listen to it anyway. I'm going to put the picture on the site. It might stir some people's memories. Is that something that you would ever heard before about this?
I have not heard it necessarily attached to this album. I have heard it in general when Peter Gabriel left, that there was a negative reaction because they were going with smaller songs and they were going with more of a pop structure. They weren't going for these huge suites anymore. And I don't know whether it was necessarily to this album's material as it was just this bizarre sense of betrayal that sometimes fans will feel, super fans, when they feel that their band is moving away from them. I have plenty of friends who love Metallica and hated them because of the Black Album, because they were moving away from thrash. It could just be sort of the same thing here, where the Genesis fans were feeling betrayed that, oh my God, they're doing 5-minute songs.
Yeah.
We came here for 15-minute songs, and what are you doing to us? It could be that, or maybe Phil Collins just really loves Johnny Cash.
Hello, everybody. I'm Phil Collins. Yeah. if there's somebody listening to this, and I assume that at least a couple people listened to it based on the last one, please correct me if I'm wrong. Fill in the details where I may be missing them, but I am positive that I read that several years ago, and it's one of those things that I read in the early days of the internet, probably on Netscape, so the site is probably long dead. Regardless, we have come to the end of Duke. Any parting thoughts on this before we ride off into the sunset?
My parting thoughts on this is that forget everything that you know about Genesis. If you know them strictly as the pop Genesis, if you know them strictly as the prog Genesis, try to go into the album with a fresh perspective, and I think that you will immediately gravitate to it, simply because, as we've been saying throughout this whole thing, emotionally, this is one of the albums, at least in the quasi-prog world, that puts it on the line emotionally. And I think one of the reasons I love it is because it's so relatable, and I think that a lot of people would get an awful lot out of it. They just gotta give it a try.
Duke, for me, is easily the zenith of the post-Peter Gabriel incarnation of Genesis. It's the perfect blend of, as I mentioned before, their progressive past and their pop future. Abacab, great songs, dead weight. Genesis, great songs, dead weight. Invisible Touch, the less said about that, the better. And We Can't Dance, great songs, a ton of dead weight. And then there was another album, whose name I forget, with some other singer guy. Watch the comments that gets.
I will say there's one song on there that I really, really enjoy, and the singer was Ray Wilson. The rest of the album, I'm sorry, Ray, I can't deal with it.
Yeah, if ever there were a way for Genesis to make the From Genesis to Revelation album sound relevant, it was by putting out Calling All Stations. Anyway, if you look at the Peter Gabriel era, I would probably put Foxtrot, maybe Selling England by the Pound, as the height of the Gabriel era. I don't know what your feelings are on that.
I think I would go with Selling England by the Pound also. And, you know, not coincidentally, that was also, I believe, the first instance of Phil getting his solo vocal, and that was on More Fool Me.
No, actually, he had For Absent Friends on Nursery Crime.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yep, very brief. You wouldn't know it. Might not remember it less than 2 minutes, but yeah, that was the one.
I have to throw away my prog cred now. I just tossed it right out the window.
Turn in your fox mask at the door, please.
Damn.
Oh God. So, you know, interestingly enough, I'm looking at some of the other side information. I know we said we were wrapping this up, but damn it, I'm having so much fun. In the UK, the album that Duke knocked off as number one was by Johnny Mathis. And it was number one for 2 weeks, and it was knocked off by a greatest hits album from Rose Royce.
Oh, there we go.
Of Car Wash.
Yeah, and that's all I know about Rose Royce.
Are you even aware of a second song that they did?
Nope.
Jesus, the UK is a strange place. That's all I'm going to say. I'm sorry, my British friends. I love you all, even though I don't like Downton Abbey, but... God damn, you people make some really weird musical choices sometimes. So my last thought on this album, I will echo what you said. You know, if you wrote off Genesis at this point, or if you listen to this album a couple times in the A's and put it away, you know, take it out again. The band is in peak form, both in songwriting and in playing. I don't think Phil really exerted himself as a drummer again over the course of an entire album like he did on this one. And again, I would agree with you, one of the great rock drummers of the 20th century. I wouldn't put him in the same class as Neil, only because he's not the same kind of drummer. But if you look at the work he was doing with Brand X, if you listen to some of the live material that Genesis was producing, I'm thinking in particular of the first archive set they came out with that covered their years up into the mid-70s. Just absolutely mind-blowing stuff. I mean, really intricate and almost, you know, on par with, say, Bill Bruford. You know, I'm just going to go ahead and put that out there. But this really, to me, is Genesis, the second incarnation of Genesis at their peak, and one of the great albums of the early 80s, and a fantastic way to start off the decade for the band. You know, a ton of promise, which, unfortunately, it wasn't completely lived up to, at least not in my mind artistically. Obviously, commercially, they became a juggernaut by the time the decade was out, but, you know, I had nothing to do with that. Don't blame me for Invisible Touch.
Illegal Alien.
Oh, barf. You had to. You had to. I was trying to avoid mentioning that, but you did it.
Well.
I thank you, DW, for joining me on this second adventure through Platters That Matter. A shout-out to our good friend Matt Wardlaw, who I know particularly enjoys that title, has referenced it a number of times. Unfortunately for him, we will not be doing any 70s Journey or REO Speedwagon on the next edition.
Yeah, we're not going into 38 Special.
We're
not going there.
Once again, I'll put a call out to anybody who is listening to this, who has made it to the end, and we're now close to 90 minutes of runtime on this one. If you have an album that you feel would be worth covering, by all means, let us know. Feel free to correct us on any of the mistakes that we made here, as I know people were not shy about doing in our Joe Walsh entry. And I thank everybody for listening. I thank the good folks at Popdose and our benevolent master, Jeff, for giving us a platform to spew our verbal diarrhea about these great albums. And until next time, everybody have a pleasant day.
Yep. Thank you very much for tuning in.